You're listening to the Voices of the Middle East on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon. This is Gudarz Ektedari, your host. I'm talking to Professor Nikki Keddie, Professor of Middle East History at UCLA. Our phone number here is 503-231-8187. If any of the listeners have a question or comment, they're welcome to call in. Again, the number is 503-231-8187. Dr. Keddie, would you maybe give us a little introduction about your book and what is it about, and some information about the purchase? I suppose it is on online, or I know you have a order form yourself too, but...
Yes, in terms of online, I would honestly recommend Amazon, which is selling it for 30% off, which is, ends up at about $12.90. And if you order just two, you can get free postage too. So that is the simplest and least expensive way to get it. It is a considerable update of an earlier book, Roots of Revolution, which has a long section on what's happened since the revolution in 1979. And it's an interpretive history of Iran, which also includes discussion of culture and gender and health and education and things of that sort, not just the political history, and tries to interpret it to make sense.
Okay, maybe just a little brief of what are your findings, basically, especially with regards to modern Iran. How do you see the modernity is changing, whether or not?
Well, that again is a very big question. In the modern period, you have Iran identifying for the first time as a nation, and nationalism becoming very important among Iranians, as well as desire for some of the things which they saw in the West. In the early phase of this nationalism was often a lot of imitation of the West, but that included things like parliaments, which and constitutions, which were behind the constitutional revolution of 1905-1911. Now, one special feature of Iran was that you had an ulama, a clergy, which were at least in part often oppositional to the government, and that's a thread that runs out through modern Iranian history. So that you have what are really unique alliances between an important part of the ulama and modernizers. You don't find that elsewhere. And I explain the historical reasons for this in the development of Iranian Shi'i organization and thought. So that you have that alliance first in a boycott of the British of a British tobacco monopoly in 1891. Then in that constitutional revolution, then people were, I mean, you had some religious forces also in the Mossadegh movement, which is the important nationalist movement, and then it comes forth again in a new fashion in the revolution of 1979. Now, of course, some people were fooled into thinking that the clerics could never be competent enough to rule and that they wouldn't really end up ruling, but either the nationalists or the leftists or some such coalition would end up having power, and that didn't turn out to be the case. But you do see that special thread running through modern Iranian history. Now, you also see, I think, a feature of a division between those who were educated and westernized and often anti-clerical and the more religious traditional mass of the population and those tied to the bazaar. And that's begun with the Pahlavi period, I would say, and has until recently kept those two groups from uniting in a democratic movement. But I think in the current period, if one looks, say, at the women's movement, you have some overcoming of that gap between the educated. Elite is too strong because it includes some of the middle class and the bulk of the population. And women's movements are sort of accepting that people have different ultimate outlooks or values, but they can still work together, say, for women's rights, for greater democratic rights.
Regarding the, I mean, you mentioned the constitutional revolution of 1905, and there are some like analysis that kind of divides the forces of movements in Iran within three groups of clergy, as you mentioned, and the secular democratic forces and the monarchy. And I guess the 1905 was the beginning of a coalition between clergy and Republicans, basically, against the monarchy and trying to bring in the Constitution. And then after that, it was changed by coming of Reza Shah to power and changed again. Now that, I mean, it changed into a monarchy again in the power. And then now the clergy is in power, and at the same time, there are some coalition building against that for a secular system to come to power. How do you see that movement kind of moving in that direction? And
well,
whether do you see a secular system, secular regime to coming into after this Islamic Republic?
I find that most people's predictions, including my own, are wrong, but I certainly think that's possible. I think it would probably have to be a secular regime that granted certain position to Islam as the major religion of the country. But I think the crucial thing for the secularists is that they can't allow traditional Islamic law. I mean, this is often not faced as the crucial issue, but I think people like Shireen Ebadi and others like her recognize this, because as long as you allow this traditional Islamic law with some of the very severe punishments and the lesser position for women, you're not going to have a true democracy. So that, it seems to me in that sense, you have to be secular. You can say that your law is inspired by Islam. I mean, the King of Morocco is doing that, and Habib Bourguiba in Tunisia, when he had a fairly quite secular personal status code regarding marriage, divorce, custody, things of that, tried to make it part of Islam. But you cannot keep really large elements of traditional Islamic law. And I should say that no country had a lot of trouble scrapping Islamic law when it came to commercial law or civil law or something. It's only on these so-called personal status questions that affect women, the family, and such, where it's really been kept in practically all Muslim countries. But either it has to be radically reformed so it becomes egalitarian, or you have to replace it by civil law, I think.
You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM. This is the Voices of the Middle East, and I'm Gudarz Ektedari, your host. I'm speaking with Professor Nikki Keddy, Professor of Middle East History at UCLA. And our phone number here is 503-231-8187 if you have any question or comments to make. Let me ask you, again, another big question, as you say. For example, for Iranian society, it is a multicultural, multi-ethnic country, so to speak. What would be a kind of a linking point between all these people and for the history? I mean, there hasn't been. There has been some movement, so-called separatist movement, but In effect, the country has glued itself together. What do you think is the reason for that?
Well, I think one reason which often isn't faced by secularists is the fact that it's over 90% Shia, and has been since 1500, when the Safavids brought in Shiism and really quite forcefully forced it on the Sunnis of the population. And that really has been a force for unity. And another force for unity has been this national identification with Iran and its territory, which I think has been strong and is boosted by a kind of revival of memories of pre-Islamic Iranian past, even though these are sometimes sort of mythical. But still, I think people do identify as Iranian. Certainly the Azerbaijani Turks, who are very much mixed in with the population and are Shi'i, by far the biggest ethnic minority, but I don't think their separatist movement is to be taken really seriously. I mean, they're all mixed in Tehran and all over the country, and I don't think separatism is nearly as big a problem in Iran as in a number of other Middle Eastern and generally non-Western countries.
Kind of another question basically regarding the Iranian expatriates, and I know you are living in the middle of at least the most populous of Iranian in the U.S. What is your opinion about the these groups who are living in the U.S., and what do you see as their ambition?
Well, of course, they're reputed to be overwhelmingly monarchist, at least those in Los Angeles, and that may be a slight exaggeration. I think they may be, a lot of them, more open than to different ideas than some people realize. But I think exile groups in general, and we saw that in Iraq, we saw it in Russia after the revolution, and I've seen it in many places, particularly where you have a revolution, think that if only they could get a little outside help or something like that, people would welcome back them and the former kind of government with open arms. And I would say I can't think of a single case in the world where this has turned out to be true, unfortunately for them, I guess. Certainly you were hearing this about Iraq, that they were going to welcome these exile leaders back with open arms, and the Iraqis have not done so. Now, there's Reza Pahlavi is putting forth a program which has some appeal. He's asking for nonviolent resistance to culminate in a referendum as to what form of government people would want. And, you know, it's hard to object to that except to say, where is this nonviolent resistance really going to come from in, at this point, in sufficient quantity to overthrow this quite strongly entrenched government? Eventually, maybe so. But I think those Iranians in the country who had, before the Iraq war, thought they would even welcome U.S. direct intervention have really changed their minds when they've seen what's happened in Iraq.
What would be the, I guess, the path now if a foreign intervention would not work? How do you see a reform in the Middle East as far as democratization and I don't want to use the word in a Western concept of it, but really providing more fair right for to the people, women, youth, and kind of providing an environment and a space for a better development in those countries.
Well, I think that say, people abroad can take the lead from those within those countries who are fighting for certain things, such as fighting for equal rights for women or fighting for equal rights for minorities, that there's nothing wrong with giving support to in terms of conferences, in terms of giving them a public platform and things of that sort. But you have to be very careful that it doesn't look like just some kind of Western plot. And I would say that that it's not up to people like me to say the path is going to be so-and-so. I mean, if you look at the history of the last, whatever, 50 years, it's never come out exactly the way people have predicted. So that it's not up to people outside the country to tell those people in the country exactly what they should do. It's, one can give them support. But the other thing I would say, that there are a couple of things. That is, as long as the U.S. gives this overwhelming support to Israel and whatever it wants to do in Palestine, that's going to distort the possibility for democratization in the whole Middle East, because it becomes an overwhelming issue for the Middle East, and sort of outweighs everything else. And as long also as the U.S. and outside countries are wanting to control that area because of oil, it also is going to distort things very much.
I believe you spoke last weekend or Saturday probably at UC Berkeley on the issue of 1953 coup d'etat in Iran. Can you talk a little bit about that event?
The Berkeley event?
No, the coup. And how did that impact?
I actually didn't talk so much about the coup as I talked about myself, in the sense that it was when I was a graduate student at Berkeley in the 50s that I really decided to go in and study Iranian history, because people often ask me. I was one of the first people to study it as a historian who was not tied by family to Iran. And it was largely because, or at least in part because of Mossadegh and his politics, which were not very popular in the United States, but I was very impressed with this nationalist and democratic leader who was daring to stand up to the international oil companies. And that's the kind of thing I talked about in large part.
And just for audience, there's a new book out by Stephen Kinzer, The Old Shah's Man, and he basically links the coup d'etat of 1953 with most of the events that in the past five decades has caused basically the rise of fundamentalism. And I don't know, what is your opinion on that? How much can be contributed to that?
Well, the way he puts it, I mean, I like the book. I reviewed it very favorably. He puts it, it's slightly oversimplified, but I would say that it's true that the Western powers really put down not only Mossadegh, but also made things very difficult for Nasser, and generally sort of blocked some of these nationalist secular movements in the Middle East. And that was one of the reasons why people turned rather to Islamic movements. And, of course, in the case of Iran, U.S. not only blocked those movements, but gave fairly unlimited support to the Shah, including many of the things that he did, which made him unpopular. That is, the U.S. didn't come out and say, we will support you in this, but in fact, they did not press him, contrary to what a lot of Iranians think. They did not press him on human rights. They made some statements in a general way, but in fact, they never really tried to stop him from doing the things internally that caused his downfall. The Shah.
Yeah, but I mean, I guess the argument is that basically that killed secular democratic movements in the region and kind of left door open for...
Yes.
I mean, it became really appealing to go... And that's what is happening in Iraq today, I guess.
Well, it may be too soon to say, but
right.
Certainly the whole situation has given a lot of power and prestige to movements that are basically theocratic in their orientation. I mean, I don't think that's what the U.S. wanted, but any more than they did in Iran, but it does seem to be moving in that direction.
Correct. I was speaking with Professor Nikki Keddy, the professor of Middle East history at UCLA, and her latest book, Modern Iran, Roots and Results of Revolution, New Haven, Yale University Press, 2003, and you can order it online at Amazon.com. Dr. Keddy, thank you very much for giving us the opportunity to talk to you on the phone.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
Thank you, Nikki. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Good night.
Good night.
Now we're going to listen to a little piece of music, and then we'll be back.